Our democracy is hanging by a thread, but we know it's not about just winning and losing each battle. It's about persistence and building resilience.
That's why we're launching the Practivist Pod, the practice of activism made practical.
If you're looking for ways to get engaged or just for ways to stay sane, we want to help you navigate what comes next.
It's an exciting collaboration with political dynamo Jess Craven, author of the Chop Wood, Carry Water newsletter,
and grassroots activist Steve Pearson, host of the How We Win podcast.
Every week on the Practivist Pod, we're going to have important conversations with changemakers, give you practical ways to make an impact, have some fun, and inspire hope.
This is more than a podcast. It's a place for our community to grow our practice of advocacy for justice, equity, and progress.
Action is the best antidote for anxiety. So subscribe to the Practivist Pod today.
Welcome to Care Talk. My name is Laura Packard, and I'm our host. I am a cancer survivor with personal experience with the U.S. healthcare system, and we have experts here to answer your health insurance and healthcare questions. So please text or call in your questions at 202-838-6837, and we'll get you answers in future episodes. Also, be sure to subscribe to my channel or podcast wherever you get podcasts for future Care Talks. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Dana, the co-founder of Contraceptive Access Initiative. She's going to be talking about contraception in America and what's at stake this year. So welcome, Dana.
Thank you so much for having me, Laura.
Thanks. And let's start with contraception and public opinion. We know that birth control is popular in America, but how popular is it?
Great place to start. Contraception is ridiculously popular. Poll after poll shows that nearly 90% of Americans overall and huge majorities across every demographic, age, state, race, gender, party, support birth control, which is really not a surprise when you consider the fact that over 99% of people of reproductive age have used contraception at some point in their lifetime. So you almost wonder who the 9% are that use contraception but aren't huge supporters of it. And I want to point out that there's particular support for emergency contraception. Sometimes people think of emergency contraception as a slightly different category. That is not actually how the American people think of it. Contraception is contraception. And so we should not create confusion there either. Now, what is surprising is, to me at least, is the fact that elected officials don't always vote on contraceptive policy in a way that's consistent with their constituents and this overwhelming support for contraception.
And we've actually seen elected officials vote against what their constituents want on other healthcare issues. Yeah. But speaking of elected officials, last year I heard a lot about the Right to Contraception Act working its way through Congress and some state houses like Virginia, where I live. Can you tell me more about what this legislation is and what it would do?
It's another great question. And, it's really baffling to see how many conservative lawmakers actually voted against the Right to Contraception Act when they were given that chance over the past few years. The Right to Contraception Act is a really simple bill. It simply would codify the right that every American currently has to contraception. And this is a right that was actually established or recognized by the Supreme Court 50 years ago in 1965 in a Supreme Court case called Griswold v. Connecticut. Now, to your question about elected officials and this Right to Contraception Act, there has been a movement over the past few years to codify that right to contraception. So even though the Supreme Court has spoken to it, shouldn't we have that, as statute at the federal and or state level? So So elected officials in Congress and, to your point, in Virginia and other states have been introducing Right to Contraception Act. And what's been really surprising and alarming has been the number of conservative elected officials who have voted against the right to contraception. In 2022, only six Republicans in the House of Representatives actually voted for this bill. Last year, when the U.S. Senate voted on the Right to Contraception Act, only two Republican senators voted for it. In state houses across the country, we had dozens, if not hundreds, of elected officials vote against it. And notably, in Virginia, your Republican Governor Youngkin actually vetoed the bill when it reached his desk last year, which, again, is just baffling. It makes no sense. As we were just discussing, contraception and the right to contraception are incredibly popular. This is not a niche issue.
And speaking as a Virginian, it's especially frustrating that our state legislature passed the Right to Contraception Act to make it so that we would guarantee that we would have access to birth control. And yet our governor vetoed it. So speaking of these elected officials that are voting against contraception, why do you think they're doing it? Because contraception is so popular in America.
Yeah, it's a really important thing to unearth a little bit here, because I think there's a division between where the American people are and where anti-abortion groups have started going. While you think of anti-abortion groups as really being about abortion, not contraception, we're also seeing them take positions on contraception, and they have an ally in Justice Thomas on the Supreme Court. And what I mean by that is when the Dobbs decision, which overturned the right to abortion in this country, came down a couple of years ago, Justice Thomas took that opportunity to actually voice support for overturning the right to contraception. And yes, you heard me right, that, you know, in this day and age, there was a Supreme Court justice who actually thinks that that we should be overturning the Right to Contraception Act, which, as I said, has been on the books for 50 years. So I think in part you're seeing elected officials follow the lead of these anti-abortion groups that are taking positions on contraception, who then themselves oppose the Right to Contraception Act. So for example, the Susan B. Anthony List, a traditionally anti-abortion group, also opposed the Right to Contraception Act, and in fact scored the vote. And what that means is by keeping track of anyone who voted against the bill, they were in a position to withdraw their endorsement for those members of Congress during the electoral season. So, you know, this is just an alarming trend of what we're seeing of anti-abortion groups expanding their territory into contraception. These are groups that have a lot of access and a lot of influence on elected officials. And I think it's important to sort of think of them in a couple of different buckets, because that gives you a little sense of the fights we're fighting right now, but also where we're going. So right now we're spending a lot of time fighting restrictions and attacks on IUDs and contraception and IUDs and emergency contraception. And this is largely because of groups like SBA List and Right to Life, who conflate abortion and contraception and have gone after these particular forms of contraception, with that sort of conflation that no, these are not contraception. These are abortion, which is, of course, is false. But it's important to also know that other groups like Live Action and the Heritage Foundation, which, of course, authored the Project 2025 document for the Trump administration, they oppose all forms of hormonal contraception. So this is a much bigger group of contraception. It includes the pill, which has been taken by millions of women, the patch, the ring, Depo-Provera shots. Like, these are very common and important choices for women to have to contraception. And finally, you see the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops oppose basically all forms of contraception, even barrier methods like condoms that are so accessible and so important for public health goals. And these groups sort of collectively have a strategy that they then take to Capitol Hill and to state legislatures, where they say, well, you know, if we redefine pregnancy at fertilization rather than implantation, then when we pass abortion bans, we're actually going to sweep up a bunch of contraceptives as well. And so, you know, there's this very insidious strategy they have of actually trying to redefine pregnancy and contraception in a way that will infringe on access to contraception and to IVF. So it's important to know that while they're starting with emergency contraception and IUDs, again, a lot of these groups oppose all hormonal forms of contraception, which is a huge share of the market and a huge share of what people rely on when they seek contraception.
So it sounds like it's not an accident that they aren't just coming after abortion. They're coming after fertility treatments. They're coming after contraception and birth control, that this was never just about abortion, and that this is affecting far more than just people that have a need for an abortion.
I think that's 100% true. And I really think, you know, these attacks are connected, right? They all relate to a woman's personal autonomy. Can we decide when and if to get pregnant, when and if to have a family? And so by sort of switching these medical definitions and sowing confusion and misinformation, they're actually justifying attacks on contraception, as and as you point out, on IVF as well. And, you know, last year, I think you and many of us saw the attacks on IVF in the state of Alabama, where families that had been working for months, if not years, on fertility treatments were actually stopped because the state law in Alabama actually banned IVF because of this non-medical definition of pregnancy. And we see that in insurance coverage as well. There was another Supreme Court case a few years ago called the Hobby Lobby case, where the family, the Greens, that own the Hobby Lobby craft stores, decided that they didn't want to offer certain kinds of contraception on their health insurance plan for their employees, that they decided that that they had personal views of what was contraception and what was abortion based on a religious philosophy, not on medical science. So they challenged the requirement that contraception be covered by insurance policies, and took it all the way to the Supreme Court. And guess what? The Supreme Court said, yeah, that's okay. You can deny your employees certain forms of contraception based on your personal beliefs. And I mentioned that story in particular because it shows the success of our opponent's strategy, that they are actually seeing dividends on this medical misinformation that they are pursuing. And we're seeing attacks at the state level as well. Recently, Governor DeSantis repeatedly has blocked funding for contraception, specifically for IUDs and long-acting reversible forms of contraception for low-income constituents. And he did this because of pressure from the Catholic Church. So we talked about that sort of third swath of groups like the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops that really oppose all forms of contraception. So these attacks are happening at the state and federal level. And they also, I guess, finally, I would say they take the form of attacking on attacking access. And so many Americans rely on healthcare clinics like Title X clinics or Planned Parenthood clinics or community health centers, these family planning clinics, to get their contraception and to get basic reproductive health care. And there's been a concerted attack and effort by Republicans and conservative lawmakers to sort of defund those clinics, which at the end of the day, all you're doing is denying access to contraception for the millions of people that rely on those clinics for access to basic health care.
Well, after all that, is there any good news you can leave us with?
You know, there's always opportunity. So I'm glad we're sort of rounding it out with that. You know, I mean, I kind of going back to the beginning of our conversation, contraception is so wildly popular. People want more access. People deserve more access. It is politically popular. It is personally popular. And it's great healthcare. Contraception has been taken by millions of women in the United States, around the globe, for decades and decades. It is very safe and very effective. And again, an essential part of basic healthcare. So, you know, even in the midst of these attacks, I think there's always an opportunity to reach across the aisle and find those who are willing to buck the interest groups and really speak to what their constituents are asking for and demanding, and frankly, what they deserve. And this can be done at the federal level. It's a little bit harder with the change in administration. And this can happen at the state level as well. And there's a lot of Democratic governors in particular who really are embracing state actions to expand coverage of over-the-counter contraception, which is really exciting. And you know, we saw just this past year, Opill, the first oral contraceptive pill available without a prescription. And this is a huge advancement in public health, to actually be able to go into your CVS or your Walgreens and get an oral contraception pill without a prescription. There's a second pill, the more commonly taken pill that has estrogen in it. It's called the combination pill. And that's going through the FDA process. So I have hopes that the FDA will listen to the scientists and medical experts and approve that for over-the-counter availability as well. So I, you know, there's always room for advancement, and that's where the public sentiment is. So I'm always optimistic.
So tell us about your organization and how people can follow the fight to protect our right to contraception.
Oh, well, thank you so much for that. The Contraceptive Access Initiative was formed particularly to help get the oral contraceptive pill over the counter and covered by insurance. So we're doing a lot of work there. And we're also trying to make sure that even as we do that, those rights and that access is not eroded. So I encourage folks to check out our website, thepillotc.org. It's lots of information about the pill, about the mis and disinformation that we talked about a little bit in this conversation, and lots of ways to take action.
Thank you so much for joining us, Dana. And now we're going to answer some of your questions. Let me start with introducing Louise from healthinsurance.org, because the deadline for enrolling in health insurance through the Affordable Care Act is fast approaching. So, Louise, what is the deadline and what do people need to do right now to get enrolled in health insurance?
Yes, absolutely. The deadline in almost every state is January 15th. There are a handful of states where they'll keep their enrollment open past that. And I do, if on healthinsurance.org, I have a page where we list the deadlines, and we do keep that updated in real time because sometimes there are changes right at the last minute. But at this point, the vast majority of states, it ends on January 15th. In Idaho, it did end in December, so you cannot enroll in 2025 coverage in Idaho at this point unless you have a special enrollment period, which is when you have a qualifying life event and then it triggers a special enrollment period. In the rest of the country, you do still have until January 15th, at least. And after January 15th, in most states, you will not be able to sign up for 2025 health insurance unless you qualify for a special enrollment period, which is, you know, you have a qualifying life event like having a baby or losing your employer-sponsored health insurance, something like that, that triggers a special enrollment period. But without that, you cannot sign up. And this is true whether you're looking to enroll through the marketplace or directly through a health insurance company. That is a common misperception. People think that if they are not shopping in the marketplace, that the open enrollment period does not apply. That is incorrect. It applies for any like real major medical health insurance. After the end of open enrollment, the only coverage you can get without a qualifying life event is going to be not real health insurance. It's going to be short-term plans or fixed indemnity plans, coverage that isn't real health insurance. So before the end of the day on January 15th, you should go to healthcare.gov. If your state doesn't use healthcare.gov, it will direct you to the correct website and look at the options that are available and get yourself signed up. And this is for folks who don't have coverage through their job or Medicare or Medicaid, and need to buy their own health insurance. If you get coverage through your job, your employer sets their own enrollment period and it's different. So if you need to buy your own health insurance, you have very little time left. Get it done by January 15th.
Thank you, Louise. So again, if you've been procrastinating, go to healthcare.gov before or I think midnight January 15th. So get it done so you have health insurance. And now I'm introducing Diane of Just Care and Social Security Works, who will be talking about Medicare open enrollment and Medicare Advantage open enrollment. So Medicare open enrollment was last fall, and Medicare Advantage open enrollment is going on right now. What's the difference and what do people need to do right now?
Great question. So the big difference between the Medicare Advantage open enrollment period and the Medicare annual open enrollment period is that right now, you're only free to change your health insurance with Medicare if you're in a Medicare Advantage plan already. And the reason why this period exists is because a lot of people sign up for Medicare Advantage plans without realizing what they're getting themselves into. They might not realize that their network can change at any time and that the doctors they thought were in their network are no longer there. So they're losing continuity of care. They might not realize that they're going to be required to go through prior authorization before they can get a complex treatment, that they might face delays. They might not realize that if they are traveling or live in two different places during the year, someplace warm in the winter and someplace else other times of the year, that their care might not be covered if they're in a Medicare Advantage plan. So the Medicare Advantage open enrollment period, which lasts through March 31 of this year, gives anybody in a Medicare Advantage plan the right to switch Medicare Advantage plans or to move into traditional Medicare and also pick up a Part D prescription drug plan in the marketplace. The reason to switch back into traditional Medicare is with traditional Medicare, you have access to virtually all doctors and hospitals throughout the US. Medicare will cover your care. You will not have to face prior authorization requirements. If your treating physician believes you need care and you want the care, almost always Medicare will cover it. The only issue with moving to traditional Medicare is that you will need supplemental coverage because traditional Medicare doesn't have an out-of-pocket limit. And so you will need to go and see if you are able to buy that coverage. You do not have a guaranteed right to that coverage, unfortunately. You can buy the least expensive coverage, but it will still cost you at least many hundreds of dollars a year. That can be worth it for the protection of knowing that you'll get the care you need when you need it in traditional Medicare. In Medicare Advantage, we've been hearing endless stories of widespread delays and denials of care and coverage, particularly for people who need costly care. So even if you don't need that care today, insurance is about tomorrow, and you may want to consider whether you want to be in a Medicare Advantage plan and take that risk. Obviously, some of those plans might actually get you the care you need, but the problem is it really is Russian roulette. We have no idea which plans are going to deny you necessary treatment when you need it and which aren't. You can pick a five-star plan that will deny you needed care. So that is a big concern for people in Medicare Advantage. So think hard, look carefully at your options, and if you can afford traditional Medicare with supplemental coverage and you can get supplemental coverage, you should consider seriously that option.
Thank you, Diane. Our next question is from Bryce Haymond from Threads. He has been posting for many days now because his wife, Raven, is currently battling breast cancer, but their insurer, Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Utah, has denied coverage for her treatment, despite the drug being FDA approved for that treatment and prescribed by her oncologist in clinical trials demonstrating its benefits. Blue Cross Blue Shield is calling it investigational with unknown benefits when used following surgery, if it's been used before surgery. So they are facing financial ruin because of paying for this drug out of pocket, which, you know, Raven needs to prevent recurrence of breast cancer. Bryce has been posting for many days now on Threads, trying to get Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield to reconsider. But Louise, I wanted to get your thoughts on this.
There are a couple of really important things to know about this. First of all, the vast majority of health plans in the U.S. are subject to, they have to allow you to submit both an internal appeal and an external appeal. This is a protection that was granted under the Affordable Care Act. And it basically means an internal appeal is where you just are appealing directly to your insurance company. You do not have to do this alone. Your doctor, in this case, the oncology team, will be able, they will be well-versed in appeals. They will be able to help you with the appeals process. Oftentimes, they will submit the appeal on your behalf, but you have to get the ball rolling on that and work on an internal appeal. So this is just where you are providing information, you and your doctor, your care team are providing information directly to the insurance company that might convince them to change their mind on the denial. If that fails, you then have access to an external appeal, which is where a third party, oftentimes your state's insurance commissioner, but there's all, there are the third party entities that can work through this with you. And again, your oncology team will be able to help you on this process. And they basically, if the insurance company has still denied the internal appeal, then the external third party can look at it and potentially get that internal appeal overturned or that internal denial overturned. If that fails, it's also really important to know that oftentimes the drug manufacturers have patient assistance programs, and you can find them by Googling the name of the drug and then patient assistance program. These are very common. Sometimes they are funding provided directly by the drug manufacturer. Other times they're linking you to a foundation that it has grants that can help to cover the cost of the medication. They all have different rules and different, financial documents that they might require you to submit. So there's no one size fits all in terms of how the patient assistance programs work. But these really are a lifeline for folks who are in need of really expensive medication and are not able to get it covered through their health insurance plan.
Thank you, Louise. Our next question is a big one from Dave Clark, who wants to know, when will the United States get national health care? And Diane, what are your thoughts on this very big question?
All right. Well, I want to answer that question, but I also want to suggest on the denial that you go to your member of Congress, to your congressperson and to your senator for help, because sometimes a call from the senator or the congressperson can get the ball rolling and can get you the coverage. I want to also add that if Blue Cross is claiming the drug is experimental or investigational and the FDA has approved it, there may be something going on there that's amiss, because once it's FDA approved, it shouldn't be considered investigational. And it's possible that there's a way to get that drug covered because of the FDA approval. But moving on to when we're going to get to guaranteed single payer healthcare for everyone, that is the $64,000 question I wish I could answer. Right now, our big fight is with private health insurance under Medicare. Congress approved that on the theory that the insurers, the corporate for-profit health insurers, could do a better job of providing health care than the government could through the traditional Medicare program, sometimes called original Medicare. But what we have seen year after year after year is that it costs a lot more to use the private insurers to deliver care through Medicare, and that people tend to get a lot more denials for their medically necessary care and delays and lack of access to the doctors they need to see when they need to see them. So even though that is happening, you know, overpayments to the Medicare Advantage plans far higher than what we spend in traditional Medicare per person and widespread denials of needed care, Congress has not been ready to rein in the private insurers, much less say, you know, you said you could do a better job, but in fact, the data is showing across the board that people aren't getting needed care and we're spending more. And we're going to move away from giving people the choice of Medicare Advantage because it's a bad choice. It's a risky choice. So that's what we're up against right now.
Yes. And we have done shows about Trump's nominees to run healthcare in America this year. And unfortunately, as we've covered in past shows, one of his nominees, Dr. Oz, actually has a background that would support Medicare privatization. So we're looking instead of public policy solutions that provide more access to care for more people at lower cost. We're looking at incoming people that perhaps support more privatization, higher costs, and less care. So back to Dave's question about when do we get universal healthcare? We also had past shows with other speakers that talk about how health insurance and healthcare works in other countries. And there doesn't have to be just one model. Canada and the United Kingdom have one version of national healthcare. But if you look at other countries around the world, there are many different ways to get a better healthcare system, better than what we have. It doesn't have to be just one way. But all of these countries have figured out something better than what we have today. Check out our previous episodes on healthcare around the world and check out our previous episodes on the public health dangers of some of Trump's nominees. And unfortunately, it does not look like we are going to get better solutions on the federal level anytime soon. Although we have seen changes in the past on a state level, such as in Illinois that just passed the Healthcare Protection Act last year to rein in insurance companies, that on a state level, there may be more possibilities for more and better healthcare than on the federal level, for right now, at least. So I hope to have a better answer for Dave sometime in the future. But right now, the answer is not great. And that's kind of a down note to finish off this show, but please keep asking your questions. We will keep answering your questions, hopefully with more hopeful answers in the future. Text or call in your questions to 202-838-6837 and join us next week and in future weeks for more. Also, be sure to subscribe to my channel or podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And this is Care Talk. Care Talk with Laura Packard is a podcast covering healthcare in America from a progressive perspective. Our healthcare system is broken, and we all know insurance companies are out of control. If you don't have health insurance or don't understand the differences between insurance plans or have surprise medical bills, out-of-control prescription drug costs, or can't get the care you need, listen to Care Talk with Laura Packard weekly on Tuesdays. What's going to happen to your healthcare under the Trump administration? From prescription drug prices to health insurance costs, from healthcare for seniors and people with disabilities to reproductive care, from care for veterans to public health, including vaccinations. Healthcare experts answer your questions every week, and they go in depth on Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, private insurance, and more. Go to healthcarevoices.org/caretalk or search for Care Talk with Laura Packard on your favorite podcast app to listen today.